And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is a Ken Hudnall show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's November the 5th. 309th day of the year. Leap year is 310th. 56 days remain till this year is over. And what a year it has been. Well, on this date in history, in the year 1138, Li Antong is enthroned as Emperor of Vietnam at the age of 2. And he ruled as emperor for 37 years. And that's a good job if you can get it. 1499, publication of the Catholicon, written in 1464 by Jehan Languiduc in Tregear. The first Britain dictionary as well as the first French dictionary. 1556, Second Battle of Panipat, fought between the forces of Hemchandra Vikramadayada, the Hindu king of Delhi, and forces of Muslim Emperor Akbar. 1605, the Gunpowder Plot, which was designed to blow up Parliament and the king. Guy Fawkes is arrested. Guy Fawkes Day is still celebrated in England. 1688, William III of England lands with a Dutch fleet at Brixham. 1757, Seven Years' War. Frederick the Great defeats the Allied armies of France and the Holy Roman Empire at the Battle of Rossbach. 1768, Treaty of Fort Stanwix, purpose of which is to adjust the boundary line between Indian lands and white settlements, which was set forth in the Royal Proclamation of 1763 in the 13 colonies. 1780, French-American forces under Colonel Lebaum are defeated by the Miami chief, Little Turtle. 1811, Salvadoran priest Jose Matias Delgado rings the bell of La Merced Church in San Salvador, calls for insurrection and launching the 1811 independence movement. Unfortunately, all the folks from Salvador want to move up here now. 1828, Greek War of Independence, the French Morea expedition to recapture Morea, now the Peloponnese, ends with the last Ottoman forces depart the peninsula. 1831, Nat Turner, American slave leader, is tried, convicted, and sentenced to death in Virginia. 1862, Abraham Lincoln, this is during the American Civil War, removes George McClellan as commander of the Army of the Potomac. He was a brilliant organizer. But that's about as far as it went. 1862, American Indian Wars. In Minnesota, 303 Dakota warriors are found guilty of rape and murder of whites and are sentenced to hang. Of those 303, 38 are ultimately executed and the others are reprieved. 1872, women's suffrage in the U.S. In defiance of the law, suffragist Susan B. Anthony votes for the first time and is later fined $100. And now her head is on a coin. 1895, George Selden is granted the first U.S. patent for an automobile. 1898, the Greece nationalists revolt against Spanish rule and establish the short-lived Republic of Negros. 1911, after declaring war on the Ottoman Empire on September 29, 1911, Italy annexes Tripoli and Cyrenaica. 1912, Woodrow Wilson is elected the 28th president of the U.S., defeating incumbent William Howard Taft. 1913, King Otto of Bavaria is deposed by his cousin, Prince Regent Ludwig, who assumes the title Ludwig III. 1914, World War I. France and the British Empire declare war on the Ottoman Empire. The interesting thing... They control much of southeastern Europe, western Asia, and North Africa between the 14th and 20th century. It's founded at the end of the 13th century in the northwestern Anatolia in the town of Sogut by the Turkoman tribal leader Osman I. Though initially the dynasty was of Turkic origin, it was Persianized in terms of language, culture, literature, and habits. And in 1354, the Ottomans crossed into Europe with the conquest of the Balkans. They became a transcontinental empire. But unfortunately, like so many other empires, they collapsed. 1916, the Kingdom of Poland is proclaimed by the Act of November 5th by the emperors of Germany and Austro-Hungary. 1916, the Everett Massacre takes place in Everett, Washington, as political differences lead to a shootout between the Industrial Workers of the World organizers and local police. Now, there's not much said about the Everett Massacre, which is also known as Bloody Sunday. It was an armed confrontation between local workers and members of the Industrial Workers of the World, commonly called Wobblies. It took place in Everett, Washington, on a Sunday in 1916. The event marked a time of rising tensions in the Pacific Northwest labor history. There were vigilantes and the police versus the workers. Donald McRae led the police and the vigilantes, and Thomas Tracy led the industrial workers. 5 died among the workers, 27 were injured, and 75 were arrested. In the police and vigilantes, they had 2 die and 20 were injured. Now, in 1916, Everett, Washington faced a serious depression. Ongoing confrontation between business, commercial interests, labor, and labor organizers. Number of labor organized rallies and speeches in the street. Local law enforcement, of course, which was firmly on the side of the businesses, tried to keep a lid on things. The industrial workers of the world had gone into Everett to support a 5-month-long strike by shingle workers. Once they got there, vigilantes organized by the businesses had beaten them up with axe handles, run them out of town. So the Seattle industrial workers of the world decided to go to Everett in numbers to hold a rally to show their support for the striking shingle workers. And as a result, a small-scale war broke out. In 1917, Lenin calls for the October Revolution. Also in 1917, Tikhon is elected the Patriarch of Moscow under the Russian Orthodox Church. Even though the communists were anti-God, they did not mess with the Orthodox Church. 1925, secret agent Sidney Reilly, the first super spy of the 20th century, is executed by the OGPU, the secret police of the Soviet Union. 1940, Sidney Reilly was a Russian-born adventurer and secret agent employed by Scotland Yard Special Branch. Later, he worked for the foreign section of the British Secret Service, which was the precursor to the modern British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. He's alleged to have spied for at least 4 different powers. And documentary evidence indicates he was involved in espionage activities in 1890s London among the Russian emigre circles. And in Manchuria on the eve of the Russo-Japanese War and in an abortive 1918 coup d'etat against Lenin's Bolshevik government in Moscow. He disappeared into Soviet Russia in the mid-1920s, and British diplomat and journalist R. Bruce Lockhart publicized their 1918 operation to overthrow the Bolshevik regime. He wrote a book in 1932, Memoirs of a British Agent, became an international bestseller, and Reilly gained international fame from it. You know, had they been successful, the world would have been much different. 1940, World War II. The British armed merchant cruiser HMS Jervis Bay is sunk by German pocket battleship Admiral Scheer. 1940, FDR is the first and only president of the United States to be elected for a third term. 1943, World War II, bombing of the Vatican. Now, the bombing of the Vatican City occurred twice during World War II. The first was on the evening of November 5th, 1943, when a plane dropped bombs on the area southwest of St. Peter's Basilica. Motion detected at the front door. Caused a lot of damage, but no casualties. The second bombing, which affected only the outer margin of the city, was about the same hour. Well, my system decided to do something else. The same hour on March 1st, 1944, caused the death of one person, injury of another. Vatican City actually remained neutral throughout the war, and both Allied and Axis aircraft crews were generally commanded to respect this neutrality even when they bombed Rome. Unfortunately, things happen. 1950 Korean War. British and Australian forces from the 27th British Commonwealth Brigade successfully halted the advancing Chinese 117th Division during the Battle of Pakchon. 1955, after being destroyed in World War II, the rebuilt Vienna State Opera reopens with a performance of Beethoven's Fidelio. 1956, Suez Crisis. British and French paratroopers land in Egypt after a week-long bombing campaign. 1968, Richard Nixon is elected as 37th President of the United States. 1970, the Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, reports the lowest weekly American soldier death toll in 5 years. They only lost 24 that week. 1983, Biford Dolphin diving bell accident kills 5 and leaves 1 severely injured. 1986, USS Rentz, USS Reeves, and USS Oldendorf visit Qingdao in China, the first U.S. naval visit to China since 1949. 1990, Rabbi Meir Kahane, founder of the far-right Kash movement, shot dead after a speech in a New York City hotel. At the front door. 1995, Andre Dallaire attempts to assassinate Prime Minister Jean Chrétien of Canada. He's thwarted when the Prime Minister's wife locks the door. So simple. 1996, Pakistani President Farooq Laghari dismisses the government of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto and dissolves the National Assembly of Pakistan. Then, and also in 1996, Bill Clinton's re-elected President of the United States. 2006, Saddam Hussein, former president of Iraq, his co-defendants, Barzan Ibrahim al-Tikridi and Awad Hamad al-Bandar, are sentenced to death in the al-Dujail trial for their roles in the 1982 massacre of 148 Shia Muslims. 2007, China's first lunar satellite, Chang'e-1, goes into orbit around the moon. Also in 2007, Android mobile operating system is unveiled by Google. 2009, and Google and Twitter and Facebook and, there's a fourth one. Their leaders became the masters of the universe. So they think. 2009, U.S. Army Major Nadal Malik Hassan murders 13 and wounds 32 at Fort Hood in the deadliest mass shooting at a U.S. military installation. 2013, India launches the Mars Orbiter mission, its first interplanetary probe. 2015, an iron ore tailings dam burst in the Brazilian state of Minas Gerais, flooding a valley, causing mudslides in the nearby village of Bento Rodrigues and causing at least 17 deaths, and 2 are still missing. 2015, Rona Ambrose takes over after Stephen Harper as the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. And in 2017, Devin Patrick Kelly kills 26 and injures 20 in a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. A lot of births and deaths on this date. Holidays. Well, whenever they want to sell, they always seem to catch me when I'm doing my broadcast. Christian Feast Day, all Jesuit saints and blessed. Domninus. Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, Galatian, Guido Maria Conforti, Magnus, Bank Transfer Day in the U.S., Colon Day in Panama, or Cologne, as they say there, Guy Fawkes Night in the U.K., New Zealand, Newfoundland, and Labrador, Canada, In the English West Country, there's the West Country Carnival. Cinco de Novembro in Negros in the Philippines. Kanakadasa, Janyathi in India. All right. Let's see if there's anything else worth discussing. Now, Guy Fawkes Night is an annual commemoration observed on November 5th, primarily in the UK. Guy Fawkes was a member of the Gunpowder Plot, was arrested while guarding explosives the plotters had placed beneath the House of Lords, and celebrating the fact that King James I had survived this attempt on his life, people lit bonfires around London and introduced the observation of the November 5th Act to have an annual public day of thanksgiving for the plot's failure. Okay. In 1492, Christopher Columbus first learns about growing and harvesting maize from Cuba's indigenous population. For those that are not familiar with, maize is corn. 1500, astronomer Copernicus observes a lunar eclipse in Rome. 1556, Akbar, who was 14, succeeds his father, Humayun, as Sultan of Delhi. He became the Mughal Emperor. And let's see. 1556, Second Battle of Panipat. Hindu Emperor of Northern India, Hemchandra Vikramadayita, defeated by the forces of...
Motion detected at the front door.
Akbar. Who later captures and beheads Hemchandra. In 1639, the first post office in the colonies is set up in Massachusetts. In 1757, battle at Rossbach in the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War. 1773, John Hancock is elected as moderator at a Boston town meeting. It resolves that anyone who supports the Tea Act is the enemy of America. The Tea Act was a British act that put a tax on tea, which upset the colonists no end because they didn't get any benefit from that tax. 1781, John Hanson elected first president of the U.S. and Congress assembled, which means Washington was not actually the first president. He was the first president of the United States. 1789, fleeing slaves under Bonnie attack a military post in Suriname. 1789, French National Meeting declares all citizens equal under the law. And then they proceeded to start slaughtering a lot of them. 1838, Honduras declares independence of Central American Federation. 1854, in the Crimean War, British and French defeat a Russian force of 50,000 at Inkerman. 1862, Ambrose Burnside replaces McClellan as head of the Army of the Potomac. And then the troops got channeled in one of the battles across a bridge that became known as Burnside Bridge. They never did take that bridge. And let's see. 1872, Ulysses S. Grant reelected U.S. president. 1873, due to the fallout from the Pacific scandal, John McDonald resigns as Prime Minister of Canada. 1881, 1,600 police and volunteers attack a Maori settlement of Parahaka in western Taranaki, which became the symbol of protest against the confiscation of Maori land in New Zealand. 1883, Battle of El Obeid, Sudan. The Mahdi's army destroys Egyptian army. I mean, completely obliterates them. And as a result of the relatively modern weapons the Egyptian army had, the Mahdi's army became quite a formidable force. Well, at this point, we're going to move on to what we're going to talk about today. We're going to keep talking about secrets of the dead. There's a lot of historical mysteries that could be solved through the use of science. Let's talk about, sometimes military secrets are guarded for decades, long after peace is declared. And let's look at some of these classified secrets that have now become not so classified. You know, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki did more than end World War II in the Pacific. It sparked an arms race between Russia and America and led to the creation and testing of the largest atomic bomb ever to exist. It was known as the Tsar Bomb, which was created by the Soviets. Now, the U.S., under the auspices of the newly formed Atomic Energy Commission, began to develop increasingly powerful weapons in the 1950s. They were designed to serve as a deterrent to Soviet aggression in Europe, but our atomic supremacy wouldn't last. After witnessing America's technological breakthrough, Stalin ordered the scientists at Moscow's Lebedev Institute to develop Russia's first atomic bomb, and in 1949, the Soviet Union tested its own devastating device. It was a nearly identical copy of the bomb the U.S. had dropped on Nagasaki. Now, when news reached Washington about the testing of this bomb, the most alarming aspect of the test was the speed with which the Soviets had advanced. Scientific experts in America didn't believe the Soviets could develop an atomic bomb before 1952. And just as worrying to everybody was the realization that the similarity in design meant Russian spies worked inside the secret laboratory at Los Alamos. In the aftermath of this shocking discovery, the U.S. announced plans to develop an even more powerful weapon. The arms race had truly begun at this point. Advancements from the atom to the hydrogen bomb between the two rivals meant the two world powers were on a course toward nuclear confrontation. When the U.S. tested the first hydrogen bomb in 1952, it was the Soviets who first succeeded in dropping one from an airplane a year later. Well, fear drove scientists and military leaders in both countries to develop increasingly powerful weapons. And in such an environment, mistakes were inevitable. Well, relations between the two superpowers, who had been such close allies during World War II, steadily eroded. And by 1961, things had come to a fever pitch. Nikita Khrushchev, who became the Soviet premier in 1958, wanted to prove Russia was on an equal terms with the U.S. In his mind, the only way to show Soviet strength was through nuclear weaponry. So he gave his lead scientist, Andrei Sakharov, 3 months to build the biggest bomb in history. Even larger than the Castle Bravo bomb the Americans had tested in 1954. And in a few months, probably under fear of death, Sakharov delivered exactly what he had been asked to do. Became known as the Tsar Bomba. 26 feet long, weighed 27 tons, and was a three-stage bomb with a potential yield of 100 megatons of TNT. If tested as originally planned, that bomb would have unleashed an explosion 4,000 times larger than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, as the deadline for testing the bomb's power got closer, Sakharov grew frightened by the potential radioactive fallout. I mean, frankly, it was nearly impossible to predict how and where the radiation would settle. So he made two significant adjustments, halving the bomb's power to 50 megatons and moved the test to a remote island in the Arctic Ocean. But the test didn't move ahead anyway, no matter what he did. On October 30, 1961, a Soviet plane rose to 40,000 feet and dropped a 27-ton Tsar Bomba, which fell 25,000 feet before detonating. The mushroom cloud was 7 times higher than Mount Everest, nearly 40 miles in height. Buildings 70 miles away were destroyed, and 300 miles away, wonders were shattered. The explosion generated the equivalent of an earthquake measuring 5.0 on the Richter scale. Well, news of this new explosive terrified the powers that be in Washington. If the Tsar Bomba were to be dropped on a major city, the Nisher fireball would incinerate everything in a 3-mile radius. People 62 miles away would suffer third-degree burns, and a death toll would reach millions. So Khrushchev's intention, which was sending a warning to America, had succeeded. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, in part because of the experience of Tsar Bomba. In 1963, the Soviet Union and the U.S. agreed to conduct all future tests underground to limit fallout exposure. And the testing of the Tsar Bomba proved a vital de-escalation in the Cold War and one that limited exposure for civilians around the globe. For many, like those in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, it was too late, though. Nuclear fallout from the bomb still lingers at Severny Island, which today is the site of a Russian army base. You have to wonder how many folks who served there have been infected by the remaining fallout. You know, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were never closer to nuclear war than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 2002, declassified documents revealed that the safety of the world rested on the shoulders of one single Soviet submarine commander, Vasily Arkhipov. It was the summer of 1962. Relations between Moscow and Washington were collapsing. The Soviets had shot down a U-2 spy plane in 1960 and begun construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961. Meanwhile, the Kennedy administration began using Turkey and Italy to station nuclear missiles capable of reaching Moscow. In response, the Soviet Union secretly installed 42 mid-range nuclear missiles in Cuba, which was only 90 miles off America's eastern seaboard. These missiles threatened Washington, D.C. and New York City with nuclear destruction. And the Soviets were not anywhere near done arming Cuba. Meanwhile, on October 1, 1962, four Soviet submarines armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons supplied with tropical clothing set off for Cuba. The U.S. Atlantic Fleet prepared for the blockade of the island. During the few days that followed, the survival of the world depended on three individuals under enormous pressure. Just how close the world came to complete nuclear destruction during those dark October days only recently came to light. Moscow had established strict protocols for its submarines to limit the chance of an accidental firing of a nuclear weapon. Launching a nuclear torpedo required the agreement of both the submarine's captain and its political officer. Political officers were chosen for their political loyalty as opposed to their tactical ability. Each man carried one half of a key needed to be joined to unlock the firing mechanism. And aboard submarine B-59, the assent of Vasily Arkhipov, the commander of the entire fleet, was also required. Only if all three men agreed could the B-59 fire its missiles. 50 miles into their journey, heading south from their secret base, the captains of the four submarines finally read their orders and discovered they were to go 7,000 miles to the Caribbean to reinforce the secret Soviet troops stationed in Cuba. These submarines would serve as the vanguard of a Soviet force that would make Cuba one of the most militarized places on the planet. Well, this trip to Cuba was fraught with the constant danger of detection. Hunting the Soviet submarines would be the most advanced American fleet, destroyers, helicopters, surveillance planes, all armed with the latest technology. The U.S. watched the nuclear armament of Cuba carefully, even as the submarines continued their approach. After a U-2 spy plane photographed Soviet missiles in Cuba, President Kennedy addressed the nation to warn the public of the new danger. In a speech on October 22nd, he also warned the Soviet Union the U.S. would regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba as an attack on the U.S., requiring a full retaliatory response. He also announced a blockade around Cuba intended to stop incoming cargoes of offensive weapons. Well, while the world teetered on the brink of nuclear catastrophe, the crew of the Soviet submarines faced an imminent risk of their own. A previous disaster aboard another submarine had made the chances of discovery a whole lot greater. 1961, after a catastrophic failure of a submarine K-19's onboard nuclear reactor, the Soviet Navy mothballed all their nuclear subs. And Vasily Arkhipov had witnessed the painful radiation death of 8 of his comrades while on board the K-19. As a result of that disaster, as a safety precaution, the Soviet Navy had assigned diesel-electric submarines to the Cuba mission, which meant that the four submarines had to be to eventually surface to charge their batteries, which increased the likelihood of detection by the U.S. forces. 40 American destroyers, 4 aircraft carriers, and 358 aircraft were hunting vessels attempting to break Kennedy's blockade. It was probably the most dangerous game of cat and mouse in history. October 24th, Kennedy placed the Strategic Air Command at DEFCON 2. According to these ratings, the next stop would be nuclear war. And inside the Russian submarines, conditions deteriorated quickly. The warm waters of the Sargasso Sea east of Bermuda overheated their vessels, and rations were limited to 1 glass of water per day. Days passed, and no new orders arrived from Moscow. Tension and fear were constant companions. On October 27th, the Americans finally spotted B-59. Relying on their training and equipment, the American sailors sprang into action. Their strategy was hunt that submarine to exhaustion. If the Americans could maintain contact with the submarine, they knew it would have to surface eventually to charge its batteries. And what we didn't know was that that submarine carried enough nuclear weapons on board to destroy the entire fleet. So the entire crisis was now focused on a single Soviet submarine, cornered, desperate. The war seemed imminent. Back in Washington, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara turned to Secretary of State Dean Rusk and said, "The sun is setting. Could be the last sunset we'll ever see." For 5 hours, we tracked and hounded B-59. Subhunters used sonar devices to create extreme localized sound directed at the submarine. And that noise was deafening and designed to weaken the Soviets' resistance. According to Gary Slaughter, who served on the USS Coney as a communications officer, we weren't trying to kill them. We were just trying to shake them up. They also dropped 5 non-lethal depth charges as a signal for B-59 to surface. Well, the crew on board the B-59 was terrified, confused, and out of contact with Moscow for more than a week. They didn't understand that the intent of American forces was to signal rather than destroy. Well, a Russian officer aboard the B-59 recalled what happened next. A totally exhausted Captain Valentin Savitsky became furious and ordered the nuclear missiles of B-59 prepared for launch. He said, "We're going to blast them now. We'll die, but we'll sink them all." And he turned to the political officer on board, who also agreed. Savitsky then faced Vasily Arkhipov, commander of the entire fleet, and asked for his missile key. Any attack by the Soviets would result in an American retaliation, not only against the fleet, but against Moscow. Nuclear war hung in the balance. Well, Arkhipov refused to turn over his key. He ordered the sub to surface, citing the need for orders from Moscow, and effectively ended the crisis. It's impossible to say for certain why Arkhipov made this particular decision. Even after the event came to light in 2002 via declassified documents and interviews with crew members of the B-59 submarine, his reasoning is still unclear. His wife believed his personal experience witnessing the effects of radiation on his friends and comrades aboard the submarine K-19 had a heavy impact on Arkhipov's mindset. Whatever may have been his motivation, after 40 years, his courage in the midst of a crisis averted a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and literally saved the world, because there is no doubt that we would have retaliated had nuclear missiles come from that submarine. Well, a lot of lessons came out of World War II. And there are still mysteries that have given us a new view of the accepted wisdom of how a number of battles played out. See, more than 1 million soldiers and civilians lost their lives in 7 months of unrelenting fighting across southern Russia. Battle of Stalingrad, which was between August 23, 1942 and February 2, 1943 was one of the pivotal actions of World War II. It also goes down as the deadliest battle in the history of warfare, an engagement that ended in a bloody war of attrition for the frozen city of Stalingrad. For decades, that battle was seen as the defining victory for a cunning Joseph Stalin, whose brilliant military strategy drew Hitler into a trap. But actually, the truth of the matter is far more complex. See, in 1939, Joseph Stalin signed a non-aggression pact with Adolf Hitler. It was a risk, but Stalin knew the Red Army was no match for Germany's war machine. He needed Hitler distracted while he built up his own defenses. In June of 41, after sweeping aside Western Europe, Germany launched their first invasion of Soviet territory. And had the Germans accepted all the Russians who wanted to join them, because they all hated Stalin, the war would have come out differently. But instead, they had their usual "your dirt beneath our feet" attitude. The Soviets called in reinforcements, which stalled the onslaught, but Hitler believed the second offensive would knock the Soviets out of the war. So Operation Blue was launched in June of 42 to destroy the Red Army. And that invasion ended in disaster for Hitler as well, and for decades it was believed Stalin ordered his men to fall back and lure the Germans into a trap. Well, historian David Glantz argues this is false. In fact, documents show Stalin gave strict orders for his men to hold their positions at all cost. On July 28, 1942, Stalin issued Order 227, which said not one step back. He ordered each army to create blocking detachments with instructions to shoot any retreating soldiers. Records show as many as 10,000 soldiers were shot by their own countrymen when they tried to fall back. Operation Blue proceeded as planned, advancing steadily through the Soviet territory. When a jubilant Hitler proclaimed the Russian is finished, he divided his force into three armies. The Sixth Army, whom Hitler believed could storm the heavens, was ordered to seize the city of Stalingrad without the benefit of tank support. As the Nazis rumbled towards Stalingrad, the Soviets regrouped and deployed armies into an area where the Don River formed a sideways U. It was an ideal spot to make a stand, but it showed their level of desperation. And this Soviet counteroffensive extracted a heavy toll on everybody. Hitler, infuriated by the slow progress of his forces, recalled the mechanized 4th Panzer to help conquer Stalingrad. Germans planned a pincer move, sending the 6th Army from the north and the 4th Panzer attack from the south. And it was at this location, according to historian Glantz, that the battle was won. It wasn't the urban fighting in Stalingrad that turned the tide, but rather a series of forgotten confrontations outside the city where the Russians made their greatest stand. 25 miles north of Stalingrad lies the town of Kutluban, where the Soviets launched near suicidal attacks to slow the German assault and keep the deadly panzers out of the city. 200,000 Soviet casualties were recorded, but their sacrifice gave Stalingrad a chance. Without that delay, the city would have been lost. In the morning of November 19th, the sound of distant guns filled the air and signaled the arrival of Soviet reinforcements. More than 1 million Russian soldiers converged on the German troops and trapped over 270,000 of the Nazis' finest. Soviets began their final assault with the Germans, who were on their last legs. Two-thirds of their troops were already dead. Those who survived were starving, freezing, and certain they were going to be defeated. Then on January 31st, 1943, the unthinkable happened. The German army surrendered. The Battle for Stalingrad was over. According to these records, the battle for Stalingrad was determined not by Stalin's tactical genius, but by Hitler's miscalculations and willingness of Soviet commanders to sacrifice men and material to slow the advancing Germans. More than 7 months of fighting left in excess of 2 million casualties on both sides. Of the 500,000 civilians who'd once populated the city, only 1,500 still remained. As the winter of 43 and the inexorable German slide into defeat had begun, without the Soviet efforts at Stalingrad and the the willingness to risk so many casualties, the war might have reached a very different end. Had Hitler defeated Russia, he would have turned and destroyed the Allied efforts. Well, in the aftermath of World War II, ordinary German soldiers claimed they didn't know anything about the Holocaust and blamed atrocities on the SS. But recently declassified transcripts of an extensive British surveillance operation reveal the truth. In the chaos and carnage of war, high-grade intelligence is as vital as firing power. MI-19, an intelligence department of the British War Office, set out to exploit German prisoners of war in a bugging operation of unprecedented scale. Three stately manors in the British countryside were converted into unlikely prison camps and wired for sound. According to historian Helen Fry, these were bugging devices. There were bugging devices in lamp fittings behind the mirrors in the fireplaces. And hidden away within these manors were listening rooms filled with state-of-the-art recording equipment. Conversations between German prisoners of war were secretly recorded and then transcribed. And these recordings, which totaled more than 100,000 hours, were destroyed in the interest of secrecy, and the transcripts are hidden for decades. Only recently have they been declassified, researched, and cross-referenced. The bugging operation also helped save Britain in its darkest hour. So, scientists wondered whether the Germans were using a secret navigation system to bomb British cities, which would, of course, help them find their targets in complete darkness. The answer came when MI-19 recorded a conversation between two captured Luftwaffe pilots discussing ex-Gerat, the navigation system using radio waves. Armed with this information, British scientists figured out a way to jam the radio navigation beams, which during the Blitz saved tens of thousands of lives. 1942, victories in North Africa brought thousands of POWs to England. Two captured German generals, Wilhelm Ritter von Thoma and Ludwig Cruwell, proved particularly useful. MI-19 supplied the generals with a radio, books, and newspapers in the hopes the news might provoke useful conversation. News of the German defeat at Stalingrad gave MI-19 its biggest breakthrough. That particular loss shook the generals' confidence. To raise their spirits, von Thoma discussed with Cruel a secret weapon that might yet save their beloved fatherland. That conversation provided conclusive evidence that the terrifying V-2 rocket did exist. And the recording persuaded Bomber Command to carry out a risky raid on the testing site, and that bombing delayed the rocket's use by several months and bought the Allies valuable time. It wasn't just operational secrets MI-19 hoped to gather. The recordings also reveal shocking secrets about German treatment of civilians. One prisoner recounted his experiences in Russia. Kharkiv was a delightful town. They had splendid cinemas, he said, and wonderful cafes. Extraordinarily lovely girls. Would simply pull them into the armored car, rape them, and throw them out again. And boy, did they curse. Unfortunately, such tales were only the beginning. Damning evidence of war crimes were uncovered, but there was still a darker secret to come. One Luftwaffe pilot described an incident. He said, an SS captain said, would you like to come along for half an hour, get a machine gun, and let's go. So we went to some barracks, and there we slaughtered 1,500. There were some 20 men with machine guns. It was over in a couple of seconds, and nobody thought anything about it. Well, these recordings are powerful evidence of atrocities committed not just by Hitler's elite SS, but by regular German forces. And shocking as these acts were, MI-19 was about to hear the Nazis' darkest secret of all. Private Pfaffenberger spent 7 years at Buchenwald as a political prisoner. Eventually, he was sent to the front lines and captured by the Allies. His account of the death camps. Okay. The attempts to sell continue. We were talking about Pfaffenberger's account of the death camps. It was recorded by MI-19. It was one of the earliest detailed descriptions the Allies had of what went on there. He said, you have no idea the amount of people killed at Buchenwald while I was there. Easily it could be 30,000. As the war ended, MI-19 had 50,000 pages of transcripts. The releasing them meant revealing their methods of espionage. Winston Churchill wanted him released for possible war crime trials, including the Nuremberg trials. British intelligence officials wanted to protect their methodology. In the end, the British chose to protect their new techniques for the upcoming Cold War, even at the great expense of bringing former Nazis to justice. Not one of the prisoners was ever convicted of a single war crime on the basis of what they said while they were imprisoned. And even then, what they would have said would have probably been looked at as hearsay, as opposed to having some documents to back it up. Well, you know, there's a lot said about the use of drugs today. In fact, if you enjoy a daily cup of Joe, as it's called, excuse me, thank American soldiers in World War II, at least for that name. But the armed forces used the stimulants didn't stop with coffee or caffeine. It's an urban legend with a grain of truth. Caffeine in the form of the troops' coffee rations was so critical to G.I. Joe's ability to stay alert and focused during the battle that when the soldiers came back home, coffee became known as a cup of Joe. But American soldiers would eventually turn to another more powerful stimulant to help the Allies' efforts against Adolf Hitler and his Nazi armed forces. They pioneered the use of amphetamines. The practice of using powerful drugs didn't begin with Allied forces, though. German pilots would often man 12-hour round-trip missions to drop bombs on enemy territory. Adrenaline would fuel the pilots for the actual operation, but an immediate wave of exhaustion would follow when the pilots would have to struggle to stay awake for the return voyage to their home base. Well, enter Pervitin, a super drug that would supercharge its users. Its effects were to pump the soldiers full of energy without fear of the need for rest or downtime. And this drug gave the Germans a huge advantage, allowing not just resilience for the pilots, but also for ground troops. It would sometimes travel on foot for more than 20 miles a day. And if you've never been in the infantry, that's a lot of ground to cover. Pervitin would also allow soldiers to do so for several days in a row. Soon, Prime Minister Winston Churchill was advised that he should consider introducing a similar experimental drug to British troops. Till recently, it wasn't proven that the Allied forces were prescribing drugs to their soldiers, but a document from a military medical officer who served in North Africa proves orders for Benzedrine came straight from the top. The troops, according to historian James Holland, the troops that were involved in the opening stages of the Battle of El Alamein were given Benzedrine, and were given it not just to keep them going, not just to keep them awake, but to give them resolve, to give them confidence, to boost their morale. In late 42, Benzedrine was introduced to the American troops as well. The use of Sherman tanks had given the British a victory at the Second Battle of El Alamein, and they were eager to keep the momentum against the Axis powers going. So General Dwight D. Eisenhower ordered 500,000 Benzedrine tablets for American GIs. Now, there were, of course, downsides to the armed forces' use of these serious drugs. Pervitin and Benzedrine could keep soldiers awake for days. It also sometimes left them with the worry they might never be able to sleep again. All they had to do was listen to the wartime speeches of FDR and Churchill, and they'd have gone right to sleep, but that's another story. Military leaders also hoped Benzedrine to boost morale and might protect troops mentally from the horrors of war that caused shell shock. As many as 1 in 3 frontline soldiers would be incapacitated by what they experienced in combat. Well, the fix would unfortunately only be temporary. That shell shock, which we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, would leave some soldiers seeking the drugs once the war was over, both to deal with PTSD and their newly formed addictions to the drugs. Benzedrine was also in use by the general population in the U.S., where passengers could order it in inhalers from the menu on commercial air flights. When I first started flying, it was still available then. What's now seen as America's first prescription drug epidemic, millions of citizens were abusing bennies, as they were called, which were marketed to consumers as diet pills and mood uppers. Still, for the militaries of all the world, The use of pharmaceutical warfare was key in battling each other with the increasingly sophisticated and devastating technological advances, like Sherman tanks and armor-piercing anti-tank guns of warfare. According to historian James Holland, for us in the 21st century, drugs are bad. You've got to see this in the light of World War II. A lot's being expected of the young men of the major combatant nations. And is it any wonder, in this life and death struggle for the future of the world, that people are going to be looking at drugs that can keep folks awake, that can keep morale improved? It's no wonder at all. And as for dealing with tanks, when I did my initial training, one of the things they did is they had pits drug in a trail. And we would get in the pit and crouch down, and tanks would drive over the top of us. You have no idea. Psychological problems some of the folks suffered as a result of being run over by tanks. One of the NCOs that was involved in training us had been a former Hitler youth, and he said when the Russians invaded, they would lay in the pits dug in the roads and hold magnetic mines on their chest until the Russian tanks would drive over them. And they would put that magnetic mine on the bottom of the Russian tank and hope to hell it kept going. Well, at the height of World War II, there were a lot of little-known conflicts that took place. One of them was in the remote jungles of Borneo. And it created a team of very unlikely allies. Well, high above the clouds, a formation of American B-24 Liberators flew above a tropical island on a routine mission to bomb Japanese ships in the Pacific. And that jungle-covered territory below them was a complete mystery to most. Sparsely populated and covered in dense mountainous jungle, Borneo had oil that made it an important battleground. The unlikely allies in this little confrontation was a crew of stranded American airmen hiding from the Japanese, indigenous troops who still fought with blowpipes and machetes, and an eccentric British major. All hell bent on taking jungle warfare to the enemy. After their sneak attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the Japanese military swiftly captured territories across Southeast Asia. But by November of 1944, though, the tide had turned. Japan was losing its grip on the area, and the U.S. was regularly bombing oil tankers coming in and out of Borneo. One particular bombing run in November of 44, the Americans were surprised by heavier-than-expected anti-aircraft fire. One of the B-24 Liberators was hit and went down in Borneo's jungle interior. And the airmen were scattered across the jungles when they jumped out with their parachutes. And not all of them survived. Dan Ehrlich and Phil Corrin landed into the territory of the so-called Wild Men of Borneo. The outside world called these natives Dayaks. They were actually a group of more than 200 different tribesmen with very fierce reputations. When the plane crashed, the Dayaks went to investigate. Eric remembers meeting them for the first time. We were sitting on the sand when the Dayaks got brave enough to come toward us. All of a sudden, they started yelling out, USA, USA. Well, the airmen learned that American missionaries had visited these jungles in the 1930s. Japanese troops had rounded up the missionaries and murdered them all, including wives and babies. And as a result, this action bred a deep hatred for the Japanese among the Dayaks. Americans were soon reunited with two other members of their crew. They also met William Makahanap, the official in charge of this region for Japan. Makahanap had no choice but to inform the Japanese about the aircraft, but he and his wife felt a religious responsibility to help keep the airmen safe. The four Americans remained hidden for the next 6 weeks. Their injuries began to heal, but malnutrition was taking its toll. And by January, each man had lost up to 30 pounds. Well, when a Japanese patrol began looking for the airmen, the Dayaks decided it was time to fight back against their occupiers. But they weren't just executing the Japanese. With Makahanap's tacit approval, they resurrected the ancient ritual of headhunting. The Dayaks were thrilled to have resumed their former custom. Headhunting had been practiced in Borneo for years because the island's colonial rulers, the British and the Dutch, had outlawed it at the turn of the century. The ban, of course, hadn't stopped many Dayaks from missing the practice. which had been an intrinsic part of their culture for hundreds of years prior to the arrival of the British. Headhunting went hand in hand with special ceremonies in the longhouses, had more to do with ritual than war. After being removed from slain opponents, the Japanese heads were washed and dried before being smoked over the longhouse fire. According to the Dayak beliefs, these were protective measures to ensure that no misfortune came to the longhouse. Japanese were wiped out by the action of the Dayaks. After 2 months in the jungle, the Americans had begun to suffer from tropical disease and were quickly losing hope. Luckily, help was on its way in the form of a very eccentric British anthropologist. By fall of 1944, the Allies were recapturing territories like Borneo from the Japanese. British plans called for the establishment of a Dayak guerrilla army to ambush the Japanese. And to lead this unusual force, the British selected Tom Harrison, who had knowledge of the Dayaks, to parachute with a team of commandos into Borneo's interior. Once word reached the Americans, they quickly set up a week-long trek to join Harrison and his guerrilla army. And after signaling to the U.S. Army their missing airmen were alive, Harrison got to work. Ignored orders to wait for the main invasion of Borneo and instead ordered his guerrillas to attack the Japanese at every opportunity. The Dayaks were encouraged to arm their blowpipes with poison darts when targeting the Japanese. Harrison said, "I didn't know if we were breaking any of the rules of war, but frankly, we didn't care." It wasn't long before Harrison realized, like Makahana before, he could unite the tribes against the Japanese by encouraging headhunting. He even put a bounty on the Japanese heads to encourage the practice. May of 1945, the Allied attack on Borneo finally arrived. Before the Americans could be rescued, Harrison needed to construct an airstrip. Less than 2 weeks, Harrison and 1,000 Dayak volunteers constructed a 300-foot-long runway entirely out of bamboo. On June 10th, the first of the American airmen was flown out. Harrison decorated the airstrip with an array of national flags and a Japanese head. Less than 2 months later, a conflict fought with blowpipes and machetes was dramatically halted by the atomic bomb and the end of the war. Well, Harrison would leave Borneo within the year. During his time there, more than 1,000 Japanese soldiers met their end. It was a small but important Allied victory that wouldn't have been possible without the bravery of his committed tribal army. Well, we turn from World War II to talking about tales of lost cities and mysteries of history. For example, are vampires real or fiction? Medieval records and disturbing archaeological finds shed light on shocking real-life vampire rituals dating from hundreds of years before Bram Stoker ever wrote Dracula. You know, in popular culture, the vampire is a creature that's alluring and terrifying in equal measure. Uses charm and charisma perfected over centuries of immortality to lure unsuspecting victims to their gruesome fates. But in the past, people didn't see vampires as fictional creatures. Oh, far from it. Genuine fear fueled their belief that they existed. Now, the medievalist and rare archaeological finds reveal clues to a horror story far more visceral and frightening than any fiction any writer could create. More than 500 years before a count from Transylvania began stalking the literary imagination of the Victorian era, 12th century English abbot wrote The Life and Miracles of St. Modwina, one of several medieval manuscripts recounting events that took place nearly 1,000 years ago. Folklore is to tell ghastly stories of the walking dead. One section describes two peasants who died and were buried and came back to terrorize villagers. They appeared at night, carrying on their shoulders the wooden coffins in which had been buried. And we will talk more about this. But until then, we've run out of time once again. So until our next time together, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.